This is Side Hustle with Luke and Omar. We'll explore what it takes to run a side hustle with talented individuals from different backgrounds and experiences. We will discuss things like taking the plunge, personal challenges, and the balancing act of maintaining a day job whilst side hustling to make the dream a reality. Now sit back, relax, as we talk to some of these amazing individuals. On today's episode, we sit down with Sean Poledana. Now, when Sean walks into a room, his presence is felt immediately. He's loud, proud, and has an infectious personality. He takes us through his love for cars and digital marketing, and how he's merged those two elements into his passion, which has become his side hustle. We hope you enjoy it. Good morning, everyone. It's a miserable Saturday morning. This is Side Hustle with Luke and Omar, and today we have the fabulous Sean Poledana. How you doing?
Hello, how are you?
We are good. How you doing, Luke?
Good, good. I totally dressed inappropriately for this Melbourne morning yesterday.
Tell us a bit about your attire today.
Yesterday was 32 degrees, so I'm dressed for 32 degrees. I'm in short, board shorts, I'm in a t-shirt, and it is like 19 degrees and raining.
It's definitely coming down quite heavily outside. I mean, you and I were like totally different because I had my Patagonia kind of raincoat on. I had pants, I've got boots. And then I meet you at the tram stop and you're like short shorts and like a t-shirt. And it's just like we standing next to each other and just it didn't look right when we're getting the croissants this morning.
But what I can say is I'm comfortable as hell. So
great.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
What can I do?
All right, well, enough about your attire and let's get back to Sean.
Let's do it.
Sean, thank you so much for coming through this morning. We understand it's quite early. So thank you for being accommodating and we're really excited to have you here. Our audience are definitely in for a show this morning. Just to start off with, give us a bit of a spiel on your background, kind of where you grew up, schooling, and kind of what's all to get into your day job and side hustle.
Awesome. So I grew up in the western suburbs of Victoria, lovely place called Melton, right? I don't know, like it was easy childhood. I've got a younger brother, 2 years younger, traditional Italian Maltese kind of family. So mum's side is Italian, dad's side's Maltese. So we just grew up living that wog kind of life.
I forgot you were half Maltese as well.
Yeah.
For some reason I thought you were just full Italian.
So no. So I had a bit of that Maltese side come on through. So upbringing was fine. Catholic Regional College, like good life there. School was always a bit of a fun one, especially when they're kind of ramming down religion, like no tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just I guess for the listeners, Sean and I went to the same school. You were 2 years below me?
Yeah. So I was in the same year level as your sister, Kim.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we had like a little friendship group with like Rashad and Kim and then like Joel. And I was even went through primary school and high school that way too. So,
yeah.
Small knit community, like got a lot of that. Then at that kind of stage, it was kind of like, do you know what the one thing I loved about with high school was?
Mm-hmm.
The amount of bloody pressure that you had to go and do well in something,
yep.
Right? And the quick thing that you had to be like, cool, you had to be studying for this and that's what you're going to go and do.
That's interesting. I never thought about that, but that is a good thing.
Yeah. Do you see that? Like with your experiences, did you feel like you were kind of like put through for like, cool, this is the one thing you need to go and focus on and that's going to be it?
Yeah, like I knew the subjects I was doing was going to be marked down. So I knew I had to like kill them to get any sort of good grade, I guess. I didn't get good grades at the end, but but yes, I totally agree. Yeah.
For me, it was like, cool, at year 10 or 11, it was gearing up for architecture, right? So VizCom, had to be good at maths, right? Year 10, it was great. I felt like I was ticking all those boxes. Year 11 somehow came. I swear I probably hit puberty at that stage and everything just like... just fizzled out where maths turned into the hated subject I just didn't want to go and do. Right, VizCom I was still pretty good at, so still being
sorry, creative. What's VizCom?
It was visual communication and design.
Sure.
Yeah, so it's a bit more of an arty type subject, right? And it had to capture everything, right? So again, with school, you had to be very generalist.
Yeah. I guess to give that context as well, we had the like, I don't remember what it's called, but those cool desks that like pivoted. And there's was like the T-squares and the set squares. I remember there was like two computers in the back with Photoshop, like really old Photoshop.
Yep.
But it was like proper line drawing and technical drawing. And
Yeah. With ink going everywhere and sponging everything. It was always good fun. And then get up to year 12. Became vice captain at South Sydenham.
Right? Oh, awesome.
Which was great. It was a good thing to go and do. And I just remember that there was just so much stress and kind of pressure as to just getting everyone to kind of perform. I had an amazing group of friends who I still catch up to with these days. Mm-hmm. So to actually think back on nearly having a 20-year-long like friendship is kind of amazing from primary school up to now.
That's quite rare, actually.
I think so, but I feel like there is maybe some people out there that still do that.
Mm.
But the one thing that we keep on coming back to is we were a great unit that dealt with a lot of stress and anxiety when it came to exams, relationships, and even teachers. It was just very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And again, all that stress to be performing well not only came within the school, but also came with home,
mm-hmm.
right? So being the first, you know, kid off the rank, you know, being the oldest, it was like, you need to go and achieve this. You need to go and achieve that. You need to be doing this. If you want to get into architecture, right, it is, you need this score. It needs to be an 80.
Yeah.
Do you think that stemmed from where your background is and where your parents are originally from? Like culturally, was it more infused by that or was it just a general thing that you go to school, you need to do well?
I think it's twofold. I think that cultural background plays a big role in that because they're wanting you to succeed. They're wanting you to do better than what they actually achieved.
Yeah.
Right? Don't get me wrong. My dad has done a phenomenal job at being I don't know how to describe his role efficiently, but it's like he works for Mondelez, which owns Cadbury, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all that yummy chocolate, it needs to be produced somewhere, yeah?
Mm.
Right? So when you think of the production factories, the processing, the food sanitation, making sure that it, you know, no traces of nuts, he looks after all of that for Australasia and also up into Dubai, so that EMEA kind of group, right? But that was him studying science, doing all this, putting hard effort and staying with the job for 30 or so years.
Yeah, well.
Right? So I felt like that was, you know, his determination, his effort, he wanted to put that into or distill that into his son.
Mm.
And, of course, having that kind of cultural background was you always had to go and do well. You always had to impress.
Absolutely.
Right? But I think also it was fostered within the school also, right? You have these things called ATARs or I don't know what they call them now, like VCE scores back in our day, where, you know, to get into a reputable university or to feel like you succeeded or you did well, right? You do your exam and suddenly you get a score at the end of it, right? And that score can make or break you.
Pretty much.
My score broke me, right? But I knew going into that where the maths was no longer my strong suit. I was kind of still keen to maybe give engineering a go, but we didn't have anything around engineering at Sydenham.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know what, I still need to go and do it. I need to give as much as I can go. And I got the score back and it wasn't very favorable. And that was the first taste of my parents' kind of sadness of, you know what, he's not been able to go and achieve something. You know, maybe we've kind of put too much pressure or what's next? That unknown.
Yeah, interesting.
Right. And when, you know, when you have Italian Maltese parents and they have this unknown thing, it keeps them for life because they stress about how you going? Are you being fed? What's life going like? It is just a lot of stress on their end. So
I can definitely relate.
Yeah.
I can definitely relate.
And they kind of internalize it a little bit. So you don't actually know how they feel.
Yeah.
It's like this weird balance of like, you know that they're not happy, but at the same time, they're not saying it. So. Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in a Middle Eastern household and both of my parents were very successful at what they did.
Yeah.
So my twin brother and I tried to kind of amount to their success.
Yeah.
We fucking like miserably failed. However, we needed to go through that to kind of then find our passions and start pushing the envelope in that direction and then creating our own success, not the success they had in their eyes, but you know, so I can totally relate to what you're saying. Absolutely.
It's a funny kind of moment. And again, first one going through it, I felt like maybe I paved a way for like my cousins and my brother to like, you know what, it's up to interpretation. It's give it a go and see how it all went.
Mm-hmm.
So funnily enough, still got into an architecture type course and it was with a TAFE. So with RMIT.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, I think it was coming down to if I ever had to go provide some feedback back to kids going through VCE or going through that year 11 and 12 now would be there are more options than you actually consider. Right. You always go with that first one, which is that highest one possible. You know, look at everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And play the game. Like VCE is basically a giant game of like Monopoly. right? If you were being really strategic with the courses that you're choosing, like, again, don't maybe go for all of the ones that get marked down. It's the hardest point because there are probably some of your passion points within there.
Yeah.
But maybe if you can dial one of them up, that's probably what you should probably go and do, right? But got into a TAFE. And then I realized that physics and engineering were starting to really constrict the creativity that I kind of loved about with architecture. I wanted to go and design like gorgeous tall buildings. I had a bit more of a geometric kind of feel with all the stuff that I kept on doing.
Mm.
And I totally forgot about that process that it still needs to stand, of right? Course. And it still needs to embrace the rain that's currently coming down in Melbourne at the moment, you know? And I felt like, you know what, this is now not the place for me. And my soul searching moment was, funnily enough, I got into retail. So I moved from a local job in Melton to now doing retail in the city. And it was a moment of going, oh, I'm now getting money. I'm getting paid for my services and it's pretty fun, but I get to go and converse with people and, you know, make people buy clothes. So at that point in time, I finally kind of left TAFE. Didn't tell my parents though.
Oh shit.
Right. And then it came to a point where I was just working a bit more full time in the city because I could kind of get away with it.
So this is still living at home?
Still living at home.
Yeah.
Right. So this is still in that like 18 to 19, you know, first getting into that kind of part. I had to tell my parents because I'm like, I'm just lying and I'm just getting all this guilt. I'm like, oh, all those moments. And they were disappointed, right? But they were like, can we make one pact with you? I'm like, okay, where's this going? Like, we want you to go and complete some sort of study, right? It was important to my dad because he went and did it, right? Mm-hmm. And it helped him, right? We want you to go and complete some sort of study, right? And we want you, right, to go and figure that part out, but we're only going to pay for 50% of it, right? Because is your commitment now to us,
cool,
right? But you're actually then going to stick with it.
I respect that.
Loved, right?
Mm.
And it took some time. I think I was actually working full-time at Cotton On for maybe a year and a half.
Mm.
I met some amazing people. So you remember Bryce, like
of course,
old partner and a friend of mine, right? So I met him whilst working at Cotton On. So I met some incredible people.
Mm.
And that's actually where my passion for advertising and business operations actually then came from,
okay,
right? To actually understand going, Cotton On back in the day, and I don't think they do now, but they don't do any sort of TV or radio advertising. But how do you keep on getting people into your doors every single day, right? What's the stimuli? What actually gets people in here? I'm like, we've got 2-4 deals, right? We actually, you know, display the store in a certain way where we can actually get people in with maybe cheaper product or product that's more timely for seasonal. And then you then want them to get to somehow at the end of the store to go try on, right? So it's all the framing of a customer journey. And these were some of the signals that I kept on coming on through going, there has to be something that I can play around with this. And funnily enough, Bryce was also doing a more creative advertising role. So he was wanting to go into more like the Clemenges and the Saatchi and Saatchis that are designing all this beautiful TV ads or this digital stuff. So more of the creative side of things. Yeah. So he was a bit of that inspiration and then got me into doing a 2-year TAFE course on media and business.
Mm-hmm.
I stuck with it. Right?
Yeah,
it was a fun 2 years on understanding consumer behavior, buying TV and radio and going, this is something that I'm really uniquely interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And the consumer behavior part was the real big driver.
Yeah, amazing. Right? It's amazing the power of spending your own dollar. I had a similar experience. My parents paid for my first TAFE course out of high school, which was jewelry making, which I was talking about yesterday.
Yeah.
And they bought so much stuff, all the equipment, everything. And like within half a year I left. And it's interesting that I felt no guilt or anything because it wasn't my money, I guess.
Mm.
But it's interesting how it sounds like from you spending your own money, it made you think about how you wanted to navigate it and what actually interests you about that sort of marketing space.
Yeah.
I think you needed to get a bit more strategic with the direction now because you're like, hold on, I'm working for myself. I love what I do, but now that I've got a sense of earning money, I've got to be careful of how I spend it. So the responsibility is almost doubled in that sense. And you're like, all right, I've got to be sensible here and figure it out for myself.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's really cool.
It was a great learning curve. And I think it's it was that part, but also the way of learning, mind you, too. So I then realised, I think coming out of the TAFE course and then going straight into my first job, was more the fact that I think I learned more at a practical level on having a room like this and discussing something and then actually maybe working together on something around that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, university was more, you go to a lecture, right? You get told something, you're writing it feverishly down, right? Because again, back in, I was starting to do digital dashboards and stuff where you can kind of have a repository.
Yeah.
It wasn't the case. I'm not that old, but it's starting to come on through.
It was pretty bad at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. It was finding its foothold. Right. But this TAFE course was you go to classes, right? The classes were led by not lecturers. They were employed as lecturers, but they actually had their side hustle, right? So they were actually, this was their side hustle of teaching back to the community.
Yeah.
All right. So being employed by RMIT, but still working for agencies, working with big brands, right? So there was one teacher that worked at Mitre 10 at the time, right? So he was kind of been playing around with how digital's kind of evolving, the retail kind of space, right? Especially for them. And I felt like that kind of community, that fostering and also having a bit of a laugh within there, we didn't take ourselves very seriously. And I think our group, our class itself, so there were three classes. We were the larrikin class, right? But we got our work done and we actually had some really good people that like overachieved compared to some of the other classes within there.
Yep.
Right. And we just grew together, which is super fun. That kind of was a really good learning experience. And automatically I was like, cool. We're getting taught to how to do buy TV and buy radio. That's an old science now. Right. But all the briefs that we kept on getting in these assignments was we want you to go and do something in digital. And digital probably back then was maybe, well, MySpace probably just died in its ass. And then we're like going into Facebook or what are people doing online? You need to create a website. Yeah.
All that crap. Yeah.
Oh, go back to AOL. Get back to that Hotmail, like chat groups and stuff. Some of the stuff that we got up to as kids on those was just ridiculous.
Yeah, that dial up. Oh, man.
That sound.
The amount of money I spent on my parents' bill by like dialing up again and again.
Oh, for sure.
So I was like, they're wanting us to do something digital, but I kept on asking, like, but we don't know digital. You're not taught us digital. How do we spend money in digital?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a clue either. So it wasn't up until I'm like, cool, I want to go and explore that. I want to unpick that. So whenever we had a campaign, I wanted to emulate some sort of digital in there. And again, it was pretty basic at that point in time compared to what you can go do now. And one of the lecturers who worked for Mitre 10, he was like, you don't want to be doing any of this stuff, don't you? I'm like, no, I want to be doing something digital, but I just don't know what the first step is.
Yeah.
Right? He goes, well, this is the final year. We kind of wanting people to hopefully get a job after this. He goes, there's a search agency that we're working with for Mitre 10, all right, at this point of time.
Search agency?
Yeah, marketing agency.
Yep.
But like, he goes, I clearly don't know what they go and do, but they're in digital, right? How about I make an introduction? Right, because I know that they're looking for like an intern or someone to start to help them because they're starting to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, you know what, let's give it a go. Right, and the interview went really well. And then that's where I kind of gone, this is the direction I want to go with. Right, and then funnily enough, they're like, cool, we want you on board. Wait until you finish off your studies, which was probably only maybe another two or so months. That was all done. Got my advanced diploma and then literally straight into a job like the next day, which is
That's amazing. Just think about playing that back for a second. Is that kind of genius? Like, because I've been thinking about toying with that a little bit myself of like, how do I take control of my week? Like, what if I did like a 3-day week and then I did 2 days of lecturing or whatever, but it's based on what I'm learning at my job, not that I used to do.
Yeah.
But thinking about it from the point of view of digital was a new thing at that time. Is it kind of genius that as those lecturers who are in a job or running a business, they have these students who have like the finger on the pulse of technology, doing the grunt work, figuring out what to do, like how to pimp out or use this technology, which then they can feed back into their business?
Yeah.
Like that's pretty powerful, I think.
Absolutely.
And then possibly then hiring, like what's happened to you is then hiring that person, you know, to then bring that knowledge into their company.
Yeah. I think it's a smart way. To be honest, that's my like end goal out of everything. Like I've learned so much over, we'll say close to 9 to 10 years now mm-hmm. with roles and everything, mm-hmm. right? But that's something I want to go and give back, because I still don't think that digital is still a little bit unknown. There's still a lot of education that is locked behind the Googles and the Facebooks of them all,
mm-hmm.
right? But you need to know what is the first way to actually figure out, actually, I want to go and do something in digital where it requires, you know, search engine marketing, or to go and do something in the paid social space, or to actually understand how we actually use digital, or brands use digital to go and commercialize and then monetize for their own kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. I mean, because I did a marketing degree, and digital has always been at the forefront of everything. And it's something that I've always pushed towards, even like little projects. I'm always kind of referring back to how can we reflect that in a digital sense, as opposed to just above the line type stuff. And it was either once I understood the concept of it, it was either kind of the search paid result kind of route, or the more user experience side of it. Yeah, and I think I fell in love more with the kind of user behavior, understanding people, how they'd pick up a device, and then totally understand how to go from point A to point B and kind of like fleshing that out. But I guess you're coming at it from that other side of trying to get people into a physical store using a digital medium.
I'm totally interested in that, and like how you work with the numbers and the terms and just how all that clicks together, how that story forms.
Well, you have to kind of think about it this way. I already told you I was terrible at maths. So then now I'm playing with budgets.
You've definitely set the tone.
I'm like, how am I doing this? I'm playing in Excel for most of the day, right? And again, like as I mentioned also, like with Omar, I was like, I wanted that UX experience, that consumer behavior, but somehow I've now fallen into a search agency, and I was actually really happy because something actually just picked up. But I'm like, this is new, this is interesting, right? But that was a whole bunch of learning. So that 3 years at Shout was all about learning.
You were at Shout?
Yeah.
No way. I was at Lava. We like partnered with Shout.
Yeah, Matt, literally our story is
I think you guys have spoken about this topic before, so this isn't like a Sherlock type thing.
I think we would have at Clip probably.
I think we probably brought it up at Clip. I mean, long story short, but this is how we all met at Clip, right? Yeah,
definitely.
You know, got to work with one another. And to be honest, I felt like that in itself, Clip days, was how we actually utilized all of our talents in that effective way by understanding what the consumer wanted with Omar, right? How do I actually go and market it, which was me, and then with Luke on how do you actually go and design it so it actually is marketable, right? Or actually improves your experience, right? In that kind of way. And we also had Chris that actually would then go and develop it or go and create it for us, right? Absolutely. So I still live and breathe that type of collaborative model, which is where I've gotten into myself today.
I totally agree.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's just funny that, you know, I spent my time learning about data, learning about keywords. What do those keywords actually then mean? Why are we typing them in? Mm-hmm. Right? I think even that why part is what everyone keeps on forgetting.
The psychology behind it.
Yeah. Right. And I think that's the extra part I'd love to go and learn, would be more of the psychology or the sociology of words and structures and how we actually put everything together. Because now, most recent update within like the Google processing and the natural language and understanding on how the AI actually gives you that result, they've called a thing called BERT. So think of the Sesame Street character, they've named it after that.
Yep.
But it's how it gives out better results based on the natural learning and understanding the to's or the from's or the different parts, the semantic structure of the keyword that you type in now to actually then tailor the result further.
See, it's interesting you bring that up, because my parents would sit in front of Google and they'll type the most well-articulated sentence.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I don't think you're going to get what you need if you type such big words and like the lockup of the sentences. I think if you treat it as a human being, like you're having a conversation with it, I think your results might come back a little bit more to what you're kind of after, as opposed to, you know, typing in like Shakespearean type sentences that like, you know, like stories.
But I think sometimes there's a degree of I don't know what I'm looking for, so I'll say it in a formal way and you'll ask it as a question or something.
Absolutely,
which I think it should definitely cater for that. And generally it does, like whenever I type something like that.
the processing, like Google, if you've ever, like, I think there's a book that I've read and actually goes through the whole process of Larry Page, and I can't remember the other guy's name, right? It escapes me at this point of time, but their whole mantra and the whole time, like, again, Google didn't exist when you had Alta Vista and I think another search product, right? But they actually developed it in some sort of way that actually gave the most relevant query, the relevant answer to your query. Right. So, and that's been the constant push. And now we're in AI and kind of natural language processing where it's actually doing that even better now. Right. That's what you should be able to go and do. You should be able to go and converse with Google Home and get the right answer coming back to you every single time. Right. Or whatever it's deemed. So it can be very, you know, in a sentence or in common language or colloquial, or it could be as short as you want. And to Luke's point, you know, that user journey of understanding that keyword from one keyword to the next point is what Ivan had to master, right? And, you know, everyone would probably start off with, let's use an example of finding something in Melbourne, right? So it'd be like, cool, a restaurant Melbourne, right? You'll probably start somewhere up there. Your scope is very broad. You're looking for something out there. Then you actually realize, cool, I'm inviting six mates, right? One of them is vegetarian. Right, so actually, I now need to refine my search further to be maybe vegetarian restaurants in Melbourne, right, to then filter down. You realize that, you know what, they're a little bit snobby, so we can't go anything below 4-star, right? So you start to go best rated reviews, vegetarian restaurants in Melbourne. Then you realize Melbourne's a bit too far, so you have to go to Fitzroy, right? This is on how you then start to tailor that entire like process from it being really broad to finally figuring out what you want, which may be vegetarian gluten with a side of something with 5-star review, right? And is also dog friendly.
The interesting thing about that is you think about that flow, that's all happening out of the digital space, I guess, like the refinement. So how do then you influence that from what's on the screen?
Yeah. And this is where I kind of then I've mastered throughout the years has been you need to, the connections are not always going to be right, but you can start to see some connections coming on through when you're looking at all the keyword data that you've got, and you can actually go, cool. The next logical stage would then be refining back to location. The next one would probably be back to review. You've then got a mixture of different dietary requirements. So you can actually then use not going 1, 2, 3 as a step 1, 2, you're then branching out. Right? It just means that your conversation becomes further. But it also means for brands, they probably need to go and cater towards everything or to say, you know what, we don't do any of that. We're only going to be doing the first 3 steps and the only one out of that. Right? It's you start to formulate these pathways by just matching terms up and how far or how small you can kind of get that volume. And it's normally that telltale sign as to how far you've got left. So how do you even bring that journey up?
It totally reminds me of when we were at Clip. Sean used to, on the whiteboard, like draw these amazing pictures out of
words. They were beautiful drawings.
But out of words. And it was like so methodical and so neat.
Very neat. Like his handwriting was awesome, even on the whiteboard.
I remember
that's why I missed my calling, probably being a teacher. That's really what I wanted to go back and give us some sort of lecture just so I could use the whiteboard.
Yeah, well, I remember thinking to myself, how is this a work in progress? Like this is the final thing. Like it's so neat, but after seeing you do that, I've adopted that that way of working.
Yeah.
Because now I have all these thoughts in my mind, and throughout like all the user research, all these things are formulating. And once I get to a point where I'm like, it's time to get these thoughts out.
Yeah.
It's like a beautiful mind, and they come out just in this like really like logical, well lined way. And then there's a little drawing sprinkled in, like how you had, which will relate to things, a little lines going back and forth.
I've been very proud that you still keep on doing that. That's really cool.
Yeah. That was because of you. Because it was like, I noticed in that moment, like there's something happening here. Like there's my version of that is very scrappy.
Yeah.
But your thought processes further. Like there's a reason why it's so neat.
Yeah.
Mm. And it doesn't mean like, I guess I had the assumption that my one was more raw because like a raw thought coming out, but the strength in doing the raw thought and then refining that thought, just how we refine our designs and stuff like that as well.
So that's obviously a testament to how you've been working and how you've been solving problems your entire life. You may have not thought about putting or doing a brain dump on a whiteboard, but it seems like whenever you've been approached with a barrier or approached with a challenge, you've been able to kind of declutter the entire situation, whether you're kind of putting it in different compartments and then tackling one thing at a time, or whether you've just been kind of brain dump on a whiteboard, this is what I'm gonna tackle first. So you've by default, you've created a method to your madness.
Yeah, because literally there's a lot of voices that keep on going and a lot of clanging of bells half the time in my head.
Yeah. Which is a great segue into, so we've all said, you've taken us through a great journey onto where you've started and where you are now. And we obviously know that your current day job is more to do with that search optimization and kind of what you love doing.
Yeah.
But this would be a great segue into the side hustle, because since you're really good at identifying problems, dissecting problems, and then tackling them, I want to know what the side hustle is. Was it an existing problem, or was it something that you just wanted to pursue because of your passion?
Yeah.
Or an opportunity.
Yeah. So if you just like introduce it first and then kind of get into it.
Perfect. The passion part. So let's go into that. So I've been a motoring enthusiast for as long as I was like maybe five, when my dad took me to my first Formula One Grand Prix race at Albert Park. Right. I've always loved cars. I love the design. Mm-hmm. I love knowing a bit about the names, how they came to be, what platform they use, you know, what engine, right? And it still excites me to today as to how far, you know, vehicles have come along in regards to the powertrain, what we use them for, right? And even the lack of love for motorsport these days, I even find that baffling, because for me, motorsport is, you know what, I will watch Bathurst, don't get me wrong, we've probably gone through two bottles of vodka whilst also watching it, right? Or have people over to go and watch the Formula One, and funnily enough, I live opposite Albert Park just for that moment, right? Just for that one time a year to go and see on the balcony a couple of the F1 cars going past.
Amazing.
Right? So that passion always been there, and I had an amazing opportunity to work with Ford Australia, and there have been amazing people that I've worked with Ford, and it was just a dream come true to go and work with them for the past, I think it was around 2 years full time, and then more of an advisory kind of role with them whilst I was growing the team at Mindshare, right? But that passion was always there. And I just found there was an opportunity, especially because I was kind of looking back from search, and you can pick up so much stuff from search or within social as to what people want, what they're interested in, and what are their pain points, right? And it was the idea of, hold on, the car buying process takes forever, right? I'm not too sure. Have you boys bought a car recently?
Last November.
All right, I'll come back to you, Luke, a little bit later and talk to you about your process. I'm fascinated to know about how you went with it. But it's a long process. It should be. You know, you're spending, you know, 50K up, depending on what you're buying, right? SUV is now very in trend and popular, so they're quite expensive. But no one knows what an SUV is. Right. To be honest, they're just a high riding hatchback. Right. But there is that. Unless you buy a 4x4, which is a body on frame. And I'm going to get a little bit nerdy, where it actually has all the gear to get you on road.
Sure.
Other than that, it's a, you know, high riding hatchback with more space.
It's a sedan that's got higher springs and it's got a boot that you can see from the back seat.
Yeah. But without the proper driving capabilities, you can't fling it into a corner because everyone will just topple over, right? But it's on demand.
I think Sean has just crushed my dreams of getting a Land Rover Defender.
That's legit, I think.
No, but that's legit.
Okay. Sorry, but please, U-turn at some point, because I want to.
I think my car's a good example of what you're talking about.
And we'll touch on that very shortly.
Yeah.
But I was like, hold on, when we have a look at it, and there was data that came across that I was actually just fascinated with. So I play with a lot of search data. I'm like, cool, I actually know what people want and what people are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But there was data that came out that said that, you know, there are 900 different touch points, digital touch points that a person goes through when buying a vehicle.
On average.
900.
900.
So we're talking Instagram, Facebook, search, like websites, apps.
Absolutely. Any single touch point. You can even go into, they actually made you search 8 times, and each interaction of that is counted as one interaction. So 8 times in Google, 1 in YouTube, going and finding something on Instagram, seeing an ad, you know, that's the touch points that I'm talking about online in digital.
I'd be bored by that point. I was like, fuck getting a car. This is too much work.
It does make sense. Like, you think about the process you go through for a car, but you're not just going to do it for one car.
Yeah.
You're going to do it for multiple cars in your range. That makes total sense.
Yeah, and especially when the SUV market is still very cluttered. You don't know what they stand for. You don't know what the size dimensions actually really mean.
Mm-hmm.
right? Because it's new. It's new. It's kind of, it's a new way and it's a fad and everyone wants to be on there and it will literally replace what we got as passenger cars. So it'll be the norm very soon.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to think of each touch point, right? And the length of those touch points. So I was like, but 900, that's a lot, right? And funnily enough, I was helping my parents going buy a car recently and I was like, literally, it was probably taking them the same amount. Until they then came to me going, you know what, can you help us? We've got two brands in mind. I'm like, ignore that one. That one's stupid. Right? Can we go and actually have a look at this one?
Can I know which one was stupid and which one was the go-to?
So my mum is a hoon. She previously drove a Subaru WRX.
Oh no, wow. Shit.
Yeah.
Like twin turbo.
Yeah. That's what she... So her requirements in buying this car was... She wanted the extra space, so she wanted an SUV, but she wanted to go as fast as WRX would. Right? I'm like, Mum, your budget, unless you're going for a Porsche Macan, right, you're not going to get anywhere close to that.
Has she ever done laps? Like, has she ever gone on the track
no,
just for
which
fun?
Which actually, I probably may give her a Christmas present just to go do some laps. Yeah. Right?
That would be
right? Hilarious. But she loved the power, and with that Subaru, so what Subaru are well known for is their four-wheel drive system.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's all-wheel drive, it keeps you going, and she felt safe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was the main thing. So I was like, I'm taking that as a safety route,
mm-hmm.
right? But also the fact that it was very agile and it moved,
mm-hmm.
right? So what the car that she was then looking for was the station wagon version of the WRX called the LeVorg.
Mm-hmm.
It's not been updated for God knows how long. They've got a current recent model that has been up facelifted a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'm like, it's not doing the space job very well. And to be honest, you then why bother spending the money on getting the same for same when it's not been updated very much?
Yeah.
Right? It took a bit of convincing, but I was like, cool. You want the all-wheel drive. You want the safety of that all-wheel drive. Right, you want the SUV capabilities, and I'm like, cool. And within the price range that you're looking at, you want that European cachet kind of feel. Why don't we have a look at the Volvo XC40, which mm-hmm. is their smaller, really gorgeous looking SUV? Right, I was surprised about the space and everything within there because I also told my parents, you start having to have to look after, you know, the grandparents, right? So, mm-hmm. having something that's low slung, because my dad's also got a Mercedes CLA coupe.
I remember when you got that.
Oh. Amazing car.
Still got the same one.
Right? But Mum used to always complain. She's like, it's a slow car compared to my WRX. And it's, you know, it's just slow. And it's not. It's the same kilowatt output. It just does it two different ways.
It's also because of the size. Maybe like the WRX will be smaller so you get a little bit of punch.
I think wheelbase, probably the same. I think they're pretty similar.
Okay.
It's the power delivery where... WRX just moved. It moved quickly because the turbo was more geared towards the bottom of it. The CLA had a bit more of a luxury pace towards it where you get more of the movement and the feel of the acceleration more in the top part of the power band.
Nice.
This is me. I get nerdy about cars.
This is
amazing because this is why the side hustle is so strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, cool. There are 900 different touch points. Everyone's trying to figure out shit and understand ways to understand. I'm going to YouTube, I'm doing search, I'm doing an Instagram, I'm talking to my mate, I'm doing this. I'm going to the deal, I'm going to the website. The website's terrible, I'm not getting much information. That's me trying to summarize potentially 900 touch points.
I love that.
Amazing.
But, and I'm going to go to Luke very shortly. I'm like, the fun fact is, when you're starting that consumer journey, I'm going to say on average, most people, they don't know what brand they're even considering.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably why you're going through 900 different touch points because you're going and understanding, great, I need an SUV because I'm about to go and have a family, right? Because I want the space. I need to put some child car seats in there. But to not then consider a brand and then having to go through that process
mm-hmm.
takes that time and takes those many touch points.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a brand in mind, Luke? When you were starting your process?
I had a brand in mind. I'm a Honda fan. Like I just love Hondas.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a Honda in mind. My wife Ellen though, she was more on the, I can upsell very easily. So like if it's like, oh, well that's an extra like 10K.
Yeah.
Maybe we should get that one.
Yeah.
But she's very much more conservative. So she looked on the budget. She started from a budget level.
Yeah.
So she really drove this ship. I was like, it could be a Honda. I would love a Volvo.
Mm-hmm.
I would love a Subaru, but
Volvos, by the way, have been looking really nice lately.
Designs,
drives.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
They have. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm just like, wow, you've come a long way from that boxy and that weird, what do you call it? Like the headrest.
Yeah.
With the stupid spaces behind it, that was like very Volvo-esque.
Yep.
Yeah.
In their station wagons, they've come a long way.
Yeah.
But even that, I didn't mind that. Like, I didn't love it at all. But it's something about Volvo I always really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just something about it. But yes, I was coming from it from a point of view of play. Like, what can we get? Like, I always came from small cars, so I'm looking at from the lens of, what if we get a small car that's just a big car now?
Yeah.
Whereas Ellen came from it more from a point of view of, what's our budget? What can we get with our budget? And pretty quickly, she distilled it down to like three cars, or three brands.
Which were
Subaru, Mazda, and Honda.
Yeah. Mm. It's good that Subaru still keeps on coming up there. They don't have to spend of like everybody else, but they still have that brand kind of affiliation there.
Mm. Yeah, well, because I'm nowhere near as car nerdy as you, but I used to play a lot of Gran Turismo and Need for Speed Underground, and I love cars from a like aesthetic point of view and like a power point of view, and playing in games and stuff. And yeah, that WRX was always one of the cars you would get. It was zippy, you would win in every race. Like it was the one. So that's always stuck with me, interestingly, from those games to now as a quality car. But I guess from there we went into the same sort of thing, looking at reviews, looking at safety, looking at fuel economy, what we're going to get for our fuel, like our money's worth and that sort of stuff. Like thinking about it from like a printer point of view, you know, you buy a cheap printer and then you pay all this money in fucking toner, like they get you. Mm. So thinking about it from that point of view, how do we make a wise decision?
Yeah.
But it really all came down to the dealer. It came down to the day that we went to buy.
And I feel like that's the part. So I'm wanting to control or at least help facilitate everything before it comes to the dealer, right? Because you're going through so many different touch points, you're going through so many websites, you're getting shot reviews on different YouTube links or whatsoever, right? You're also factoring, you know, friends, parents. Parents play a big, strong role.
Yep.
What I'm wanting to kind of do with this side hustle would be to condense that entire journey into one asset, into one aggregated review website, where you're actually able to go and get all that information depending on what you are actually looking for, whether it's on budget, whether it's on safety, whether it's on engine displacement, whether it's on size, fit, family, where you're able to go and refine and get a full holistic aggregated review from all the top editorial websites that are available into one step. So then you feel empowered to then go to that, you know, showroom to then have that conversation with the dealer.
Yeah,
so
totally.
Are you trying to shorten the 900 touch points into a consolidated, what are we talking, 100 touch points? Or because I'm assuming once you aggregate things, you'll still have links in there.
Absolutely.
To go to like YouTube and
we
other
won't.
Things.
I won't be able to go and shorten it from, you can't shorten it to zero, right? You still need to go and do your own. But I'm wanting to shorten it enough that they feel empowered. So the concept is called Drive Aid. It is an aggregate kind of website.
Drive Aid?
Drive Aid.
Aid,
You know, your aid in finding the perfect vehicle for you. It's an aggregate website, all right? But it's to help you. If you had to start from somewhere, it's at least giving you, you know, instead of having to spend the next month on doing 300 touch points, you can just kind of go straight and skip to the next, right? I know which vehicle I want. I know if it's compared against these ones for like, but it's got these really good reviews or a con here or there. Mm. So I feel empowered enough to either do specific research or to then go to the dealer to then have that conversation into potentially driving it or purchasing it.
Yeah, definitely. Because if you had that from that one site, like from Drive Aid, it would also open up your scope of other brands you hadn't considered.
Yeah.
Because we sort of like, our case is a little bit unique, whereas our car was about to die. Like we went to the mechanic, we knew it was about to die. So we saw an opportunity for a small window of, if we trade this in now, no one knows it's going to die besides us.
Mm-hmm.
So if we trade this in now.
Do you know, that's more common than not. Like I've had people think like that.
Yeah, yeah. and we walked into this dealer with, I guess, like what Drive Aid is looking to give you, with a cheat sheet in our brain of, we understand this car we're looking at is the one, but we just need to be sure.
Mm. Yeah.
And it all really came down to the guys at Mazda were really rude. And it just was like, it was only like another 5K more of our budget. We totally could have bought it.
Yeah.
But they were just like really rude when we set our figure. So we're like, cool, let's go back and get the Honda. Like we weren't thinking of buying today at all.
Mm.
But actually, while we were in there, I turned to Ellen and I was like, are we going to buy a car today? And she looked at me and she just was, I think so.
Okay, so basically the entire value proposition around Drive Aid, I beg your pardon, is to minimize those touch points that you've identified.
Yeah.
So the entire idea is to aggregate it into one kind of punchy thing.
Yeah.
That's your first go-to. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it's kind of entirely up to you if you want to cross-check and cross-reference. Where are you with this at the moment? Have you figured out the kind of algorithm in the background? Is it a website? Kind of talk us through where you are with it at the moment.
Yeah. So the interesting part has been, so I was like, I should go and do something because I read car reviews, I watch them online. So I'm wanting to digest that. So that's been actually the hardest part, right? Is actually understanding on, Sean, you do realize that you're probably going to have 10 different types of aggregator reviews on one vehicle alone. One vehicle probably has multiple different models, right? But you then have to consider not all models then get reviewed by people, right? So how are you even going to structure? So it's the phase that I'm in is data collection and infrastructure.
Yeah, well.
Right? I was talking with Luke previously about design. I think design is going to come into it once I get the data and the infrastructure
done. Yeah.
Right? Because that has been the long part where you're actually having to aggregate and actually understand as to what do people actually want? What do I actually need to know? If I'm providing them that gorgeous cheat sheet, right, I need to give them in a very synthesized manner as to that it does this or it doesn't do this. But how do I then go and compare every review in this type of parameter, right? And but that's what I'm going to try and give you. That is the algorithm that I'll try to create with DriveAid that actually at least pulls in all this information for it to distill it down into some really key points on the website, but it has all this information that it is family friendly, but it can be compared towards this, but it's in the top 10 percentile in terms of getting bought. So you feel like you've got that customer, you know, backing behind you, right? It's how do I get all that data into one database? And that's what I've been currently working on at the moment.
Sure. So you're literally just setting up the structure in the back end and kind of figuring out how the data is going to come through.
Yeah.
Different platforms, et cetera, et cetera. So how long has that kind of taken you so far? I mean, I'm not too sure how far you are into it, but
long time.
Just talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. Because like I said, you can't just have one car review, right? You also have to think that the user journey is not designated to Australia. Right, so great. Australia maybe has two or three leading car review websites, Car Advice, Cars Guide, and something, I don't know, Drive, that's it. Right, but we're not constrained to, you know, Australia. We go and listen to CarWow and watch their reviews. We go and listen to Canadian people to go and talk about their stuff. And this is the thing that I kind of, when I was working with Ford, and it was kind of the pressure point was they had to regionalize and localize everything. They weren't able to go and pull a really good review on the Ford Focus RS that was done in Canada or done somewhere else and put that on their website because they didn't feel like it was Australian enough. Or the model that was shown overseas would be different. And I'm like, to be honest, people don't care. They're using it as a measurement stick.
Yeah,
right? If it looks
internals,
bloody cool racing around on a racetrack, right, and this is free earned promotion that you got that you didn't pay for, live it, bring it somewhere, right? And that was a journey that I took, and we kind of got to a point with the launch of the Ranger Raptor, right, by having a bit more of that information out there and using that type of earned media, but not many manufacturers going to do that. So I had to think, it's consumer first, So people will be going and listening to the Canadian review, the UK review, listening to the Australian stuff, you know, and going to these manufacturer websites, whether they're good or bad.
Yeah.
Right?
It's how do I actually distill all that information, especially when it's visual, audio, and also written into something that a consumer can easily use as that checklist, right, to go, you know what, thank you. I now know that this car is not right for me or is right for me. My next stage here is either cross-shop it with someone else or actually now go and do my price negotiation, right, with the showroom.
Yeah,
right, because that still is very heavy-handed in retail mode, which won't change for the next 10 or so years, right? As long as I feel armed enough that this is the right car for me, then all I have to go and do is probably go and cross shop against a couple of showrooms. This person said I can go and get it this much, or my mate's got me over there if I can get it this price.
Okay.
So I feel good enough now
to
make that. That's my next negotiation. I don't have to do anything more.
Yeah, because then you walk in with the power, I guess, or with a bit of power.
Yeah.
Right.
So, what I'm hearing right now is you've gone through this entire thing of working in retail, figuring out consumer behavior, getting into digital, figuring out search, getting really deep into search.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of dragging your passion into that as well, where you're helping to facilitate a way for people to figure out what is their next big decision in buying a car. Because you're either buying a house or buying a car. Those are the big two kind of decisions they have to make up, in your lifetime at some point. So it seems like you're merging those two and you're still very early on, which is really exciting. Yeah. So what I wanted to ask and kind of get into a little bit more is that balance at the moment between the day job, the 9 to 5, and where you are right now with the search. Because obviously that very initial part could be quite overwhelming.
Yeah.
Because you're pumping yourself with so much information. But I just wanted to hear it from your point of view, where you are right now, and how can you kind of keep that balance where you're still passionate, but you still need to do your 9 to 5.
Yeah, great question. The good thing about my 9 to 5 is I kind of use some of those elements that I'm doing for Drive Aid for that 9 to 5. So it's kind of nice that, you know, I live and breathe that type of mental capability in that process with clients that are not doing what I'm currently doing.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a job that I'm doing. So I've got my 9 to 5 focusing on that. And then once I get home, when I'm not swimming or, you know, going out, I then have to then allocate time, right, to then pursue Drive Aid. And that's what I'm saying. The whole data integration and making sure we've got the right infrastructure is taking a lot longer. Because, you know, it's a lot of thought process. It's putting stuff into, again, seems probably a bit archaic for the time being, but, you know, scraping information that's freely available for people into an Excel file, right? But then going, you know what, no one's going to read a 500 article, word article. What is the sentiment out of that, right? So what tools can I go and use out of that? So it's very much, you do realize that you do your 9 to 5, you come home, you may have cooked yourself dinner, had time to relax. You put on a TV show in the background and you can kind of casually watch or have something in the background.
I'm assuming it's some sort of trash TV or...
Some of you just don't have to, like, if you're going to be watching a good drama or anything, no, put your computer down. You know, spend the time, right? Or when you're not with people, right? You can't just quickly always be on your phone doing shit anyway, right? So put something on in the background, right? Probably trashy, right? Probably reality TV.
Always.
And then just data, right? Yeah. And then you realize that somehow it's gotten to 12 o'clock and you may have only just completed maybe one or two nameplates. So one or two models, because again, you're having to synthesize the data in a right way, collate all the data. And this has been the hard part. This has been the moment where, you know, manufacturers are releasing vehicles left, right and center to cater different markets.
Yeah.
Right. And there's always a new nameplate or a refresh. When a new refresh or a nameplate comes out, that means there's new content.
Yep.
Right. Yep. So the content that I may have had a month ago, they may have re-released content. So I now need to make sure that that's relevant.
Yep. I guess what I wanted to dig into was more around the 9 to 5, the side hustle, you swimming, which you mentioned earlier, and then personal life. Have you managed to figure out a formula where you can kind of... have buckets where you're like, okay, this week I'm going to spend X amount of hours here, X amount of hours there, and just kind of get into that a little bit. Because obviously when you have your 9 to 5, it's very structured. You go to work, you come back home, and then you've got the evening free. But now your evening's being filled. And you've always got different motivations at different levels, and it needs to match your mood. There's no point of you sitting there doing shit when you're not 100% into it, because the output is going to be not the best.
Yeah.
So kind of talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. So my weekly routine. So again, if I'm doing swim training on Tuesdays, to be honest, I am too brain dead to do anything after that. right? It takes a toll. We're in the pool for an hour and a half, and the coach can sometimes be an ass. Love you, Jason, but you're an ass, right? So that's a no-go. I won't be touching that because I know the effort being put in will just be me on the computer looking like a cat just doing this. Not much,
yeah.
Right? So, yes, assigning a time where you feel like you can get the most mental availability is going to be key. At the moment, it's more like on a Thursday because I don't really have much on. Or having to designate some of the weekends. Like there are weekends that I have free and I'm like, you know what? It's a passion point of mine. So I'm going to be more of an okay to go into that. But it's just allocating some time to just go, cool, well, it's data collection this time. Or now I'm having to go and figure out what does the actual site structure look like against these personas based on that.
So you're kind of casually plugging your time in. You're not really setting any hard deadlines for yourself yet.
No, like I think, I want this to be out start of January, right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right? We're at the stage now, most of the data collection is done,
mm-hmm.
right? It's, like I said, there will probably be a couple of reviews that will come out during this time, but it is what it is. You can't keep on collecting or else you won't move on.
Yeah.
Right? So you need to know what that dead point is.
Sorry, January 2020?
Yeah.
Sure.
Right? So now we're into kind of just site structure and infrastructure there to at least get that point out and get the test out there. Right. So it's now allocating time on some of the weekends or on a Thursday to go and have conversations about, cool, if I'm wireframing, this is on how it should go and look like. Here's on that journey. If I had to go and supplement that for a family trying to find these types of information, are they finding it enough? Or if it's a person's wanting a more of a performance aid, have they got more of that information quickly?
Mm-hmm.
Great. I feel like I've touched on that.
Mm-hmm.
Can then move on to development. Right. So it's just the allocation of time where I see fit. I do have a deadline, but I'm not going to be like, I've got commitments with swimming. I can't do much afterwards because you just get too brain dead.
Yep.
And it's not like I can go supplement my 9 to 5 because the 9 to 5 I still find very enjoyable. And that's my client's time, you know,
definitely
building that business up. So you have to just allocate where you see fit.
Yeah. And I guess, and you're motivated to release this thing. So
it
kind of somehow fits in that mode.
And I think, you know, having some sort of deadline, even if you, you know, cool, 2020 January, right? I'm going to achieve it, right? But to know if you don't, you go, cool, well, what's been the reason why? Have I dedicated enough time with it? Having that conversation with your own self is probably going to be the first thing that you need to go and do. Actually go, cool, well, if I didn't hit it, it's not upsetting. I now need to go make it done by the end of January, right? Have that chicken moment. Have I done it? Have I not? And then assess as to what you've been wanting to go and do because you've not been dedicated that time, then maybe it's not longer your passion point.
Yeah. So I guess because it's a passion, you've been able to sacrifice your spare time to kind of put into this. And there hasn't been any kind of resentment yet towards this thing or towards it taking up your time because what you're trying to do is merge both of your what you've learned so far during your day job and your professional experience with your love for cars. So it's going to be a genuine offering and a genuine value proposition at some point to someone. What I wanted to know is, how do you deal with stress? Because obviously we've worked together before and we know when you reach a certain point where you're just like, I'm about to rip all my hair out. I've had it with this particular client, et cetera, et cetera. So kind of just give us a bit of a breakdown on how you kind of deal with stress and, you know, managing multiple things.
Yeah, I feel like the one thing that I learned about quite early on this year, actually, because I hadn't felt as stressed or as anxious as I was in my previous role, was writing stuff down in a little journal.
Okay.
Right? Writing your thoughts, your feelings at that point of time. And to be honest, it's not just, Stacey did this, she's a bloody slut. It's not that kind of stuff. It's actually asking yourself questions, right? Why are you feeling sad, right? It's not just because. You need to actually then write down as to what's making you feeling that way. Why are you anxious? What can you then go and do about that? You actually ask more questions to yourself and you actually write more questions down in this book.
So then do you answer, you answer the questions in the book as well?
The book also.
Yeah, cool.
Right? So it's kind of, it's something that I learned when I did a bit of, because I had to go and I need to go and see a psychologist because there was part of my time where I was just like, work's not great, relationship's not great, I don't know what I'm doing at home and all this kind of stuff. So I needed that help. And to be honest, go and find that, right? I think that's always going to be your first step. right? But for me, what had worked, especially in moments that I'm feeling very flustered, stressed, or anxious, has been going back to this book, right? And it's a gorgeous book. Like, you two would be very fascinated, but it's beautiful pages, right? I've got a gorgeous pen that I write in, so it feels very special, right? But the content goes in. And then personal, you know? It's not hidden away anywhere, right? Because I needed just quick access. And always, if it's in my visual range, I can release and remember, maybe I should maybe write something in.
Okay.
Right? And yeah, I kind of just ask myself questions. Why are you feeling very stressed? Like, what can you go and do about that?
Is that something that you taught yourself, or was it something that you got help from?
It was a suggestion, but you still get, you know, when you're in these moments of going through a bit of help here or there, you just do word vomit out and you feel like that's that in itself is release, right? And they may give you one or two things to go and try, but it's not much in terms of that education. My education was actually going, it's not about my day, it's personally asking myself questions to then analyze what I want out of that.
So you're critically analyzing yourself when you're approaching these things and just going, all right, let's dig in deep, Sean. Let's figure out what the fuck is wrong here and kind of figure it out.
I love this. Like, I feel like I'm in the same place right now myself. I kind of feel like I'm drowning a little bit. And I literally just thought to myself, the only way I'm going to get out of this is to write a list of what I need to do. But maybe I need to go deeper and look at this sort of level of, why am I drowning? What's making me feel this way? And try and answer those questions. And I think that kind of segues well into, I guess, the where you got that idea from, and if you've had any mentors, I guess, to help you along this journey, both like professionally and side hustle wise.
Yeah.
Has anyone been, I guess, instrumental in helping you shape the sort of way you've conducted the like life, I guess?
Yeah, I feel like I had really good bosses at my previous role at Mindshare, right? Adrian Epstein and Phil Oren, they allowed me to go and excel and make me who I was. And, you know, just they left me with autonomy but came in when I needed them at most, when I was at that critical moment of being stressed or needed their advice on something.
Yep.
So that was really good. But also good networks. Like, these boys I've known for God knows how long now, right? Having that kind of conversation, if I ever felt like that way, it was going to be very easy, especially when it comes around with work.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I feel like I don't have someone that you kind of hold that I'm going to do like praise to. I don't, that's never been me.
Mm.
Right. But it's just taking on, if you've got an opportunity to go and like find help or go and talk to someone, whether they're a friend that you work with, whether they're your boss, whether they're just someone outside of work.
Mm.
You know, just ask them, hey, you know, I'm not feeling okay, or I just want to have a conversation, or I need your advice on something. Hopefully they, first of all, make the time, right? If they don't, maybe, but if you have that time, then use that time in the right way possible. And I feel like that's where it's not about talking about how shit my day was. Mm. It's actually, hey, I'm feeling like this. I'm questioning this. I'm, you know, how can I get your advice on that?
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
I feel like that kind of process of the book or writing stuff down has been very helpful to, again, understand what is sometimes the pain point rather than just going, I just need to do this.
Mm.
It's not just output first. It's actually understanding what is the rigor between to actually go, you know what, the output wasn't that.
Mm.
It's actually, I just need to do this better, or it's a conversation.
And I'm assuming you go back to that book on a regular basis. And you just go, all right, I'm faced with the same thing.
Yeah.
This is what I can do. Or in your spare time, without needing to go back to it, you can go back and have a bit of a laugh and go, oh, I was in a bit of a rut 6 months ago.
But that's why I always have a visual there, you know, don't hide it, right? Because it's quite nice. I'm like, oh, you know what? I'll go and have a look because it's lime green. It's like, it's very in your face. Not the book stand that I've got in my bedroom.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm like, I'll go and open it. And I'm like, oh, that was a very interesting moment I need to go and have. And actually that allowed me to go and have a conversation with that person.
Yeah.
Right. And it actually turned out fine.
I absolutely love this. And I love the fact that it's lime green. It's like out there. We're not hiding our feelings. It's like,
yeah,
it's okay to be vulnerable and to write these things down. Further to Omar's question, so do you go back and read the stuff, or is it once it's out sort of
thing? No, I go back to it. I feel like, and especially if you're then going to use it again, like I think to Omar's point, like have a look to see if it is the same kind of issue that you've probably gone through.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great opportunity to kind of go back if you're having to reuse it.
Yeah.
But no, I've not recently used it, but I know that it's something that I probably want to go back to.
Sure.
Right. Just to see on how far I've come, because I know it's something that I started in October last year.
Yeah. Well.
Right. So it's going to be interesting to see.
So
what
it's already been a year and a bit now.
It's already been a year and a bit now. Yeah. So it'd be quite fascinating to see what challenges I had to go and put into that book.
Yeah.
And how have I kind of tackled that, or what were some of the conversations that I've had, so I can always remember it.
It's going to be an amazing piece, thinking back to like earlier on in this session, this podcast, whatever we want to call it. You were talking about giving back and possibly like teaching and like education, that sort of stuff. This could be an amazing resource to embark on somebody, or to when someone's feeling down, to show them your
vulnerabilities. That's what I've been itching to ask.
Yeah.
That's exactly that point. Luke picked it up really quickly, is that, are you going to use this learning that you've implemented for your life day in, day out to kind of assist that next person that might be going through some shit and kind of teaching them some of those skills on how to reflect and how to deal with certain situations?
Yeah, I'll be more than happy to. I feel like that's my personality. I'm always here to go and talk to with my friendship group and all that kind of stuff. Whether I feel like that's the topic I want to go and give back to the community, I kind of feel like maybe that's something that's common knowledge, but again, maybe it's not.
You'd be surprised, man.
And I feel like that's if I had to think of my career, it's like you realize that common knowledge is maybe sometimes not there.
Absolutely.
And sometimes sharing an experience like this, or talking about what we actually want to go and do as a side hustle, or the moments that we have that are pain points, could be ways that people can go, you know what, I can skip that now because I know that might be coming, or I won't feel anxious when that happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So having moments like this where we can go and converse about, I think, is quite lovely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd kind of love to go and do that. Like I said, I feel like still maybe the topic is a little bit, like, common. But
you'd be surprised.
You'd be so surprised. Yeah. The amount of people that say to me, like, oh, you're a robot for how much work you do and how you can, like, function at a high level in your job and the amount of hours and stuff.
Mm.
And like, I kind of like take it as, yes, I'm a robot. I love doing this stuff, but really it's fucking hard.
Yeah. Different people go through different things in their lives and their upbringing is totally different depending on where they grew up in the world. But you'd be surprised. Common knowledge is never common when you're talking to a total stranger. And even if there are any commonality, you might bounce ideas off and learn yourself. Learn for yourself from it. So there's always opportunities to go in different angles and
100%.
Yeah. And again, like onto that point too, like I'm good at listening to other people and helping them along their journey. I was terrible at myself, right? And that came out really obviously in October last year, where I'm like, cool, handball myself over to seeing someone, right? Because it was, you know, work was stressful at the time, relationship and all that kind of stuff. And you know, the side hustle didn't come from until I had clarity, right? Until I figured a lot of that kind of stuff out. And I'm like, you know what? I've now actually got the drive. I always had the passion. Like I was still reading car reviews, but that was more the escape out of it, right? What can I go and do about that?
Mm.
Yeah, definitely.
And it wasn't up until I freed up some of that clutter. And, you know, some people, I'm an open book. But sometimes with some of the feelings and thoughts that I do have in my head, I'm not always going to converse, and having that as an outlet or questioning that has been very helpful.
I can totally relate. I mean, with my upbringing, we've been taught to kind of not express our feelings too much and to be very much a man and all that shit. But in terms of pursuing your passions and having that mind space or mind to actually do it, to having the headspace to do it, is very important, because your passion is not going to come through when you've got a million fucked up things in your head and you're having to deal with so much like anxiety and all that. It's not going to be pure. You're not going to enjoy it. It's going to feel like work. So I think decluttering and paying your dues in that aspect of figuring yourself out and figuring out where your head's at before you get into your passion is very important. And I think that's something that people need to learn before they even start taking their passions a bit more seriously and, you know, materializing it into a successful hustle.
Absolutely. Because as you had said, like, you know, where do you put that time, right? So you need to have the mental availability, right, to actually go and do that time. And you may need to have that conversation with your loved one, your family, right? Or with your commitment to yourself to go and do, you know, training whatsoever, but you do need to make that sacrifice, right? But what does that sacrifice actually mean, right? And do you have that clarity or that time designated towards that?
Yep.
you know, sometimes it just doesn't. That's probably the majority of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. 100%. Well, we're starting to wrap up a little bit, but...
just before we wrap up, yep. I have a burning question.
Ooh. Yes, do it.
Think about geeking out on cars.
Yeah.
When you were at Ford.
Yeah.
Tell me how you abused that opportunity in the sense of, did you go to the show? Did you go to the rooms? Did you see things being built? Like, what did you do?
You abused that opportunity?
Not abused. Take advantage. Like, what did you do?
I actually really didn't. I always wanted, like, in my head, I was like, oh, I'm going to be going away, like, at a festival on New Year's Eve. Like, it would be great to go and get a Ranger, right? To store all the tenting gear and all this kind of stuff. And I just didn't, right? It was just one of those moments where I just felt, wow, I'm doing my passion whilst also doing my day-to-day job. That in itself fueled that.
But is Ford one of your favorite brands or not really?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I still catch up with two people from the marketing team around there.
I'm not talking about them being your favorite client, but as a car manufacturer, is that one of your favorite brands?
Oh, here's a funny story, right? So, motor enthusiast, right? What do you reckon he has on his screensaver? A car, mm-hmm. right? On his computer. So I'm going into a Ford meeting and the car of choice that I had on there was a BMW M2 competition.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, I think it was a BMW, I think M2. I think the competition didn't come out when I was working on there. And literally, so when you plug in your laptop, the first thing, of course, is just going to come up with your desktop, right? So in this boardroom with most of the marketing people and Andrew Clifford, so Cliffy we call him, right? He was like, Sean, that's not a Ford product. I'm like, well, tell me when you finally get a Ford product that can actually go compete with this car, then I'll actually have it up on there. And I'll put the PowerPoint up and I'll be selling the PowerPoint.
Well, at least it wasn't a Holden.
That's very true. He just pisses himself laughing because, again, he knew the passion because I literally put that out there. I was like, this is amazing to work on.
That's amazing.
But no, I wish I did because it would have been great to maybe have, like, you know, a Mustang for a day. Or, you know, to have the ute when I wanted it or, you know, to get the Ranger Raptor because that thing's intense.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? It would have been fun to play around with that. But, you know, respect when it respects you. And like I said, that was just a passion point for me. So,
yeah, definitely. It's good.
Awesome. So we spoke about we've talked about search, we've talked about swimming, we've talked about cars. Are there any other hobbies outside of those three things that you do? Because we know you're a bit into music and some other kind of things associated with that.
What else? I do love music. I am a tragic pop princess queen. You remember from the days of working with one another, I think the fight over like who was playing on the UE Boom at the stage and you're like, why are we listening to this crap? It's Kylie, it's okay. I have been on the committee for some LGBTI representatives, so I'm a gay male. I've been on the committee for the Glamourhead Sharks. They had paved so much of my knowledge of the community, but also I feel like growing up very quickly, right? Because I got to swim with them at early age of 21. So I had a bit of a lull before, you know, coming back into swimming.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been with them nearly for 9 years now, affiliated, but also have swum.
Awesome.
And just some of the learnings that you get to know from people in their 60s that had fought through, you know, the oppression that had gone through about being gay and all that kind of stuff. So it helped me level shit out very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been on the committee for that. I'm very proud when it comes to that kind of stuff. So whenever there's a community event to go and raise money for the club or to bring events like the Gay Aquatics over. So the Gay Aquatics called IGLA are happening next year in around, I think, February or March. Right, so Melbourne won that, but then we have to then raise money to actually put it on.
Sure.
I'm more than happy to then put a bit of makeup on, put a wig on and a dress and then start to, you know, raise money that way. So a bit of drag never hurt nobody and it's good fun to go and do. So
definitely not.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, a bit of passion in that part and just aspiring to that. But swimming in cars and, you know, catching up with people is pretty good. That's
awesome.
Enough.
That's awesome. Sean, you are a great human being. Obviously, we've known you for a while. We've worked together. It's been amazing. Did you have any last words or any kind of last thoughts for some of our listeners?
It's tough. One thing, I think, you know, if I'm having to do my day job, like don't think search is more than just numbers and data spreadsheets, right? If you have to think about the passion point, what people want, what are people interested in, your quickest way to find out is to actually go and use that search engine, right? And there are free tools out there to go and use that, to go and explore what could be your next podcast topic. Mm-hmm. How do you actually understand what the consumer profiling could be, right? Because once you actually use some sort of data source like that, you can go and do some amazing things. And I think that's been always been the one thing that's kind of connected me throughout, whether it's my side hustle, where it's without work, whether it's actually understanding what people are wanting or feeling, mm-hmm. right? Search has always been there. So, you know, consider search. I think that's kind of a fun point, and use that data in a more wise kind of set.
Awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Awesome. I want to use it more. I just like struggle to, I guess with some of the things going on, it's hard to find the time to dedicate to it.
Yeah.
But I totally agree. If we dedicate that time, it'll help focus us into where we're going.
Well, I think by default, we kind of live our day-to-day by it when we're looking for restaurant recommendations, when we're looking at the weather, when we're looking at the latest Kanye West album, for example. Like, search is your first go-to, like whether we're talking into it or typing into it.
Each one of us would have three different search profiles, right? Don't get me wrong, you can't map that, right? You can't get that. But that's what makes us unique.
Absolutely.
Right, that's what makes us human, right? Mm. You know, understanding what that is understanding the truth serum of what that consumer actually wants, right? And you can do some good, and I emphasize on the good on this part, right? You can go and use it for bad, you're an asshole for doing so, right? Do it for the good, right? Let's provide a platform for us to go and have a conversation. You know, let's create podcasts like this that actually can be, you know, found by people that are asking that same question every single time. Right, or actually to then start a passion project here or there that you actually want to keep on doing. So
absolutely.
I feel like that's, you know, ingrain everything in search. It'll be fun to know.
Well, thank you so much for waking up early this morning to drive down to the studio and sit down with us to have a conversation, I hope.
And also for the cute little, like, look, there's gorgeous croissants and a cute little drink. It's lovely.
Oh, and thank you for drinking vodka at 9:30 a.m. It's a good start to the weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Definitely. We're looking forward to putting this episode out. It's going to be fun. And is there anything you wanted to plug in? Any of your socials, website, portfolio that you want, if people want to follow you?
Yeah. If you're looking for more like client brand kind of stuff, follow Ubiquity Lab. Come find us on there. We do some amazing work for clients on that point of view. I don't suggest following my Instagram because it is very thotty and I don't recommend doing that. If not, find me on Facebook. That's probably the more like cleaner version of everything.
Well, we'll plug you into the show notes if anyone wants to follow you and wants to take that risk into breaking into your Instagram.
Once I launch DriveAid, once I get that kind of all done up. So look out for the start of this year. So
awesome.
Awesome.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys. Appreciate it.